This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Friday, so it is time for our week in review, with stories this week at the intersection of the pandemic and politics. Just this afternoon, Boston announced students will not return to all in-person schooling in September. But Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker says he wants kids in class.
We want to see kids get back to school, because all the evidence is that it can be done safely.
This, as extended unemployment benefits expire tonight, and the pandemic triggered the sharpest economic contraction in modern American history, hitting Massachusetts particularly hard. Here's Boston Mayor Marty Walsh.
If new forms of relief don't arrive, many families and individuals are going to face some serious struggles here in Boston.
The pandemic struggle ever intersects with political struggle across the country, and the battles are sharpening as our first pandemic national election nears. Federal officers are being pulled out of Portland. The House Judiciary Committee jousted with Attorney General William Barr over police tactics and election security, while President Trump suggests the November election should be postponed, citing the false claim that mail-in voting is fraudulent.
You know, so many years I've been watching elections, and they say the projected winner or the winner of the election. I don't want to see that take place in a week after November 3rd or a month or, frankly, with litigation and everything else that can happen, years.
Not for nothing, but Massachusetts is a mail-in ballot state. And here at home and in communities across the country, we said goodbye and rest in power to civil rights giant Congressman John Lewis. Here's Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley.
It is especially hard to have lost him at a moment of renewed reckoning on racial justice at a time of such unprecedented hurt.
All that and more are on the table this hour in our Week in Review, so join the conversation. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So our panelists this week are Renee Graham, Boston Globe columnist and WBUR contributor. Thanks for being back with us, Renee.
Thanks for having me.
And Tom Nichols. He's a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and the Harvard Extension School, and a senior advisor to the Lincoln Project. Tom, welcome back to you, too.
Thanks for having me.
So obviously a lot to get to, but I want to start with what we heard at the top there, because I think it's kind of a perfect illustration of the tensions we're facing in this pandemic. You got Governor Baker wants kids in schools because it's what kids need. He thinks it can be done safely, while Mayor Walsh is taking a more cautious approach, and teachers' unions are saying September, it cannot be done safely. The unions negotiated a 10-day delay in the start of the year. They're advocating to start all online. Is there even a definitive way to say who's right, Renee?
I think there is. I think that Mayor Walsh is correct in this instance. Look, I think the governor, is right in a way as well. Kids need to get back to school. We know that for many kids, this last semester was a lost one. You know, they couldn't keep up. They didn't have the tools they needed, and they fell behind. Keeping them out of school is going to make them fall behind even more. However, there is no indication that the city nor the state really know how to do this safely. And I think it will work in some communities, but I think there are other communities that are already cash-strapped that won't have the money for PPE or extra hand sanitizer or the things that will be necessary to make it safer. Because we can't make it safe, but I don't know that they're going to have the tools to even make it safer.
Tom, do you agree? And what about the idea that the sticky wicket is just we're not putting the money there?
Well, the money is always a problem, but I think the question of, who's definitively right is an almost unanswerable question, because it's really a matter of risk rather than being right. And it's a matter of how much risk people are willing to take. And I think, asking teachers to take these kinds of risks, I think people forget that when you send the kids back to school, there's a whole infrastructure of adults that are involved with sending kids back to school. And I personally am on the side of lower risk. I'm a father. I live in a community that's also trying to decide whether to send its children back to school. But we need to have a really serious conversation, not just about who's right and how much money is involved, but also risks and a plan B, because I think a lot of people really want this to be a one-time decision. We're either going back or we're not going back. We're staying home. I think, you know, we're going to have to do this the way the most responsible states and countries in the world have done it, which is a little bit at a time, keeping track and being ready to have an alternative plan or to backtrack if things start to look bad. And that's just complicated. And yes, money is an important part of that, but having a plan, you can have all the money in the world, but if you don't have a plan and you're not really committing to doing this the right way, then the money's not going to help you.
So let me throw some of that back out to listeners. Call in with your thoughts, listeners, 1-800-423-8255. Do you know your school's plan? Have you been being kept apprised, or are you waiting for a big announcement? And do you feel your school district is going to have the money it needs to invest for students to come back safely? Are you worried about the tension between coronavirus risk and other kinds of social emotional risk, learning risk? What is on your mind? And you can expand that into travel restrictions, economic reopening, because we're going to talk about all of it. Again, give us a call. So I'm going to play a little sound here in a second. You know, Governor Baker is not scaling back, despite some small upticks in the averages, for example, our positivity rate over the last several days. The Massachusetts Medical Society tweeted on Sunday night and has said they think maybe the state should consider backing down from phase 3 to phase 2. The governor isn't ready to do that, but he did say he's open to kind of lowering the number of people allowed at gatherings if the spread continues. Here he is.
If we continue to see a rise in new cases and changes in our public health data, we'll have to consider a number of options, including reducing the gathering size back down to a smaller number.
So when I heard him say that, and we talked with some doctors earlier this week about this too, if we continue is fairly vague. So what's the metric? Is it if this happens for 3 weeks? Is it if it happens for 5 more days? Is there some threshold where the number's just too scary? Do you guys have a sense that we have a plan other than watching the numbers and kind of groping our way through it?
No. I mean, you know, the governor spoke today about, you know, the fact that the positivity rate has gone from 1.7% to 2% in recent weeks. He talked about these clusters from large gatherings that have been popping up. And HHS Secretary Mary Lou Sutter's talked about the slow creep of cases going up. I can't figure out, with this information and with what health professionals are saying, why it has to continue to go into phase 3, why it can't slow down a little bit. I think that you can't get that back. Once it starts to tick up, if you're saying, well, we're okay, we can keep going, it's not going to be okay. I thought it was very telling that the governor at his press conference today unveiled this new public awareness campaign encouraging residents to wear a mask. This is 4 months after the initial shutdown. I think it needs to be taken more seriously that these little clusters, look, it's summertime, people are out and about. We've seen the pictures of the beaches. We've seen the pictures of the party boat in Boston Harbor last week. People are not abiding by it. People are tired of it. And the problem that's going to happen is these cases are going to go up. And when you hear things like, you know, Florida has broken its single day record for cases, you know, Massachusetts does not want to be the next state to become that headline. So, you know, I think you have to go slow. I don't think there's anything in saying, you know what, we need to ease off a little bit because we are seeing this increase.
I want to go to the phones here, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Patty on the line from Marston. Patty, go ahead.
Yes, I would just like to say that I totally agree that it should be based on the risk factor for teachers and for children. There's no definitive proof about how children transmit the disease or get it. And also, I'm, as a teacher myself, I'm very concerned about the long-term effects. Even if you have a mild case, which the World Health Organization came out with that report this week. And I just think parents also need to know that children are not going back to the schools that they left. They're going to be in very sparse, empty classrooms at desks, 6 feet apart all day. And
Patty,
I
let
don't
me take it from there. Thanks. Thank you, Patty. And I also want to correct, sorry, Marston Mills. I'm at home and my iPad screen sometimes cuts off part of where a person's from, which is pretty important. So Tom, let me invite you to build on and respond to Patty from Marston Mills, who was building on what you said in the first place.
One of the things that I think is really disheartening about this is that the entire country has approached this with what I think of as a lack of maturity. And this is a national emergency. It's a national crisis. And instead, people are saying, well, it's been 4 months and I'm tired of this, so I want to get on a party boat in Boston. You know, sorry, guys, World War II lasted 4 years in this country. You know, sometimes you're just going to have to bear a longer period of hardship. And I understand that parents need to have their kids go to school. They need to get back to work. But, you know, they need to not get sick and die as well. And I think, you know, it seems to me that we still haven't put our arms around that question of risk and seriousness. And the experts, this is a particular kind of heartbreak for me. The experts cannot answer this question for you. This is a question of public policy. And in places, you know, I think now we have good examples of places like Florida where people say, well, I just want everything open and I want to do what I want to be able to do. Well, then, you know, live with the consequences. The problem is the rest of us have to live with the consequences too. I would like the schools to get back in. I would like to see students, you know, learning and not falling behind, but I'm also not willing to put teachers in the intensive care unit to do that. And we have to have a real conversation about, you know, what costs are we willing to bear now that this genie is out of the bottle? This is a pandemic. This is not just a seasonal problem. This is the first time in ages that we've had a really serious global medical emergency. And I think I definitely agree with Renee that we're just not taking it seriously enough.
I mean, I think Tom makes a very good point. I just wanted to say quickly that this isn't only about the students. This is about the teachers and administrators and the staff. And, you know, Pete, they can't be looked at as collateral damage in sending kids back to school, because if the idea is that, well, kids aren't as much at risk, well, you can't say that about their teachers and administrators or staff members. So I think much more consideration has to be taken before they make this move.
Let's go back to the phones here. We got a couple of calls kind of on point for the two of you. 800-423-8255. First, I've got Kendra from Dorchester. Kendra, go ahead.
Hi, so I'm an educator in Somerville, and only just last week were faculty given a survey to record responses about going back. Families were given a survey weeks before that. However, the data shows that everyone is uninformed and no one knows what they're doing. There's no safe way that we can reopen schools for adults, students who take public transportation, their families who they live in multi-generational homes. It's irresponsible and reckless to claim that schools are anti-racist and advocate for justice while also going back and putting so many adults and children at risk. We have to stay remote. We have to stay remote for the fall, and only until
thanks,
then
Kendra.
Can we assess our risk. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm going to take it back from you because I want to add Lisa from Harwich. Lisa, go ahead.
Hi. I think I came in kind of in the middle of the conversation, but what was spoken of when I came in was just discussing the severity of the numbers going up. And one thing I continue to not hear being discussed within the numbers from news sources is that numbers going up is not necessarily an issue when more than 80% of the people are going to manage it fine at home. And so when we're talking about the pandemic and the safety issues, it's really about not overwhelming the medical system, which we, at least here on the Cape, have not done, not even close. The numbers are going up and people are getting sick and they're managing at home like they would with the flu. And what I would just like the media and the people to start talking about to stop panicking people is to have some clarity and realization that that is okay if the numbers go up, as long as we're not overwhelming the medical system. Because people
thanks, Lisa.
Are managing
I'm going to take it back from you from there.
Do.
Thank you. And I do want to point out that the dashboard that the state is using has a number of metrics. Hospital capacity is one of them. Positivity rate is one. Overall cases, I believe, is another. So there is a balance at the state level. There is a balance of the metrics that the state is watching on its big 5-point dashboard here. There was a lot in those two calls. I know there are two things that I want to hit. I want to go back to Kendra to start, Renee. She's a teacher in Somerville, and Somerville Mayor Joe Curtatone is taking a different approach here. Here he is speaking to WBZ-TV4 earlier this week about compliance, kind of also to Tom's maturity point in the state's reopening and the governor's handling of the crisis.
This approach by the really the governor and the Commonwealth of self-regulatory, self-compliance is one that's proven to be a failure. We're not a selfless society. I'm sad to say that. We go around here, we've spiked the football to victory. We have state beaches and parks and other facilities that are overcrowded, people refusing to wear face coverings at a time when the rest of the country's on fire and we know a resurgence is gonna hit us.
So what that makes me think of, Renee, is that the governor has taken a very strong stance about the extent to which he can force people or is going to choose to force people into behavior. Mayor Curtatone seems to be taking a little bit different approach there. What do you think is the balance in that space?
Is seatbelt use enforced? Is using a phone that's not hands-free enforced? Yes, they are. We're talking about a pandemic. We're talking about a virus that has killed 150,000 people in less than half a year. So what is the point of governance if you're not going to govern? What is the point of saying, well, we have a mask requirement, but we sort of encourage people to do it? No, you have to enforce it. Otherwise, what's the point? You know, people aren't going to willingly do say, look, you know, I've always thought the weakest link in this, in a way, was telling people that if you wear a mask, you'll protect other people. I don't know that we care enough about other people to really do that. I think it shows that we don't. I think if the idea is that if you wear a mask, you protect yourself, and you protect your family and the people you care about, maybe that would have a different approach. But I just don't understand the idea of what is the point of having a mask requirement if it's not going to be enforced. We've seen it. It's not enforced at beaches over and over again. And you can't have this sort of, you know, a reaction after the fact and say, well, let's do something. If you have the beaches, then you have to restrict how many people can park, how many people can be at the beach, are they socially distanced? And they just don't seem to want to do that. And so they shouldn't really be surprised that there's been an uptick in cases.
So, Tom, I'm going to turn this to you, but before I do, I just want to note that at the press conference today, when WBUR Steve Brown asked the governor about enforcement, he emphasized that he is leaving enforcement to cities and towns. So, Tom, there was a lot there in what Renee was just saying in our two calls from Kendra and Lisa. Lisa's point about, are we watching the right data? Before we go to a break, let me just give you a chance to kind of weigh in.
Sure. First of all, I think I think Renee's absolutely right that unfortunately protect other people is not working. I think one argument you can make is the sooner you all wear masks and act like adults, the sooner we get back to something like normal. And I'm just amazed at the resistant people's resistance about this. But I will defend the kind of open up people on one aspect. Renee pointed out, well, you know, we enforce seatbelt rules. Yes, but if you don't wear a seatbelt, you don't go broke. You don't lose your job. You don't end up unemployed and on relief. I think maybe even a better analogy would be to say, you know, if there's an outbreak of salmonella, we close the restaurants. We don't let you eat there. And yes, even if people go broke, that's because we don't want you all to die and bring it home and then kill your families. And unfortunately, that people are not adopting that approach to it. And, you know, eventually you can end a salmonella outbreak. But in this case, it's going to take cooperation. And people are just not willing to cooperate. They really want this to be over because they're tired of what I think are some pretty minimal invasions on their personal liberty. And I think it's, in a way, it's childish, but it also is self-defeating because the longer people resist these measures, the longer this business is going to go on. We could go back to school more safely. We could open things more safely as they did in Germany or Korea. But unfortunately, we don't have enough Germans and Koreans to make that work. We have Americans who don't want to do those things. And so here, you know, here we are stuck in this situation.
I'm Tiziana Deering, and still with us are our panelists, Renee Graham of the Boston Globe and Tom Nichols of the U.S. Naval War College, and you. Give us a call. We are talking about the intersection of the pandemic and politics, and it is a big, gnarly intersection. Let us know what you're thinking about it. In this segment, we're going to really talk about the national economy and what that means for the November elections. 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. So, earlier this week, and by earlier I mean yesterday because that's how time passes now, the president issued a tweet floating the idea of postponing the election in November as a result of his concern about corruption with mail-in voting. Many called that out as a distraction to the numbers that were released yesterday of essentially the worst rolling average GDP drop, meaning annualized GDP drop, in modern history in the country. And we found out today that at 43%, that is also, in fact, the case for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. When we talked about this yesterday, here's what Michael Curry, former Boston NAACP president and member of the NAACP National Board of Directors, said about the president's idea and some reassurances we had gotten yesterday from Secretary of State Bill Galvin.
We know that there's very little fraud, voter fraud, and that that was really a distraction under the Trump administration. So why don't we just move forward? There is no reason to delay an election. We're hearing it from both sides of the aisle. And I think the secretary gave us pretty solid confidence that we can make this happen.
So I'm going to try to discipline us to kind of comb that out and follow his comment as our logic. So let's start with, did we need to be distracted from the size and scope of those economic numbers? How big a blow is that, Tom and Renee?
It's gigantic. And it was expected. Once we had to shut down, there, you know, every sensible economist in the country said, be prepared for a contraction this size. It should be manageable in the sense that we are a fantastically wealthy country and we ought to be able to carry this burden, as a national emergency. And I just want to add, you know, I keep using this term national emergency, and I think people, I know that sometimes people out there, when I've used this language, they kind of roll their eyes. This is a 9/11 every 3 days now. This is, we're coming up on three times as many people dead as in the entire Vietnam War. You know, we managed to get through 4 years of World War II with, having to finance that and take on a lot of very difficult measures. We're going to have to do that now. This economic contraction was something that everybody who, you know, saw coming, and we knew it was going to be horrible, and we have to think about it. And instead, of course, this is, by the way, where I should add, I don't speak for the Navy or the Naval War College or anybody else. But I think this is where the failure of leadership at the very top of the country really becomes apparent, because, you know, back in January or February, we should have been preparing for the level of the blow that we were going to take once the impact, we could really understand the impact, and we should have known this was coming. We should have been better prepared for it.
So, Renee, speaking of preparing for the blow, so meanwhile, we've got this $600 additional unemployment benefit that came from the CARES Act. It expires tonight. Over the last few weeks, we here on Radio Boston have talked to a number of members of our congressional delegation who, of course, all Democrats, and we know the Democrats passed their version of an extension of that in May, all expressed some optimism that Congress was going to be able to get this thing done. Here we are, clock's ticking. It goes off tonight. Nothing has gotten to the president's desk. How bad is it that we can't get Congress to make an allocation here? And how desperately do we need more government intervention despite our worry about the trillions of dollars that it's costing us?
You know, this is devastating for millions of families. You know, that $600, you know, wasn't necessary. It wasn't, you know, fun money. People weren't going out and buying great things. People were doing this to keep their heads just above water. And now to not have that, to know that your leaders could not get their act together enough to get this done, to help these people, is absolutely appalling. There's no excuse for this. Now, look, this is the kind of thing you say, yes, leadership matters. And I do hope people remember this in November. Because there was absolutely no excuse why the Senate should have gone home instead of dealing with this. You know, it's not going to hurt them, but it's going to hurt their constituents. And I hope when people get to the ballot box, whether they do it in person or by mail, they remember that their leaders turned their backs on them in their hour of need during a national emergency. That, amen, through no fault of their own. That's the thing we have to always get back to. None of this had to happen if the federal government had reacted quickly when they had the information instead of dawdling. Now you not only have 150,000 people and counting dead, but you have millions more who are absolutely desperate because this government cannot get it together and do right by the American people.
And so, Tom, amen. therein lies the intersection of what Michael Curry was talking about, because what Renee said was, so now I hope that when people go to the ballot box in November, whether it's in person or via voting, and that's kind of the cluster of these news stories this week, right? You have the president talking about postponing. He says it's because of concern about voter fraud. Others say it's because he's concerned he's going to lose because of his response to the pandemic and the economic downturn since then. I want to play. So we asked Secretary of State Bill Galvin to come on, Massachusetts Secretary of State, yesterday to respond to the president's, question about postponing. And we asked him, frankly, how secure is mail-in voting in Massachusetts. I want to play a little bit of that.
The voters who received the application to apply for a vote by mail application might have noticed there was a barcode on it, which was their specific barcode. We made sure that none of the mail was forwardable, so if people had moved, it was returned to us. We also made very clear to people that if there's any effort to illegally vote, and by anyone, not necessarily the person to whom it was addressed, it will be prosecuted, and it will.
So, Tom, usually just about the time somebody starts to talk about barcodes, I lose interest. But I was very reassured by the level of specificity. Are you feeling like we are ready for a mail-in pandemic election?
It doesn't matter if we're ready. We're going to have one. And I think that a lot of the arguments about this, look, let's talk about the elephant in the room, which is the incredible politicization of this pandemic. There's a reason the Republican Senate went home, because the only thing that the president and the Senate care about now is saving the president, although I think most Republicans have given up on that. And now they're really about saving the Senate and the down ballot Republicans. And they don't want to be responsible for any of this. They want to stay as far from it as they can. And they also know that the faithful among the Republican voters have been pushed very hard not to think in terms of blame. So when Renee talks about the failure of national leadership, a lot of Republicans just hear the Democrats, when in fact, this was the time for presidential and majority party leadership in both houses. But the president cares about is suppressing his own vote, because a lot of Republican voters are older people who are not going to be able to go to the polls safely. But this is now the new mythology. And so we're going to have a mail-in election. It's going to happen. It's safe. I was always a little uncomfortable with at-will mail-in elections, only because I wanted people to go to the polling place. I wanted to have a civic ritual. I wasn't against mail-in voting because of fraud or anything like that. But we can't do that. If there is a time for people to let go of their previous biases and preferences and say, we are in an extreme situation. Everyone should be voting by mail. It is safer. The government should be spending tons of money to take care of people, because that's what a national government should do at a moment like this. And instead, we are riven by questions of who will this benefit? Who will this help politically at any given moment? And that is just that is really a shameful approach, because that is not a civic and national approach to this. And I think it's part of that the process that we've all been talking about from the first part of the show, of Americans just throwing each other under the bus during an emergency. And I think it's terrible. We're going to have a mail-in election. We need to have a stimulus. It's got to happen. And, it's just a matter of when things get miserable enough that people have to decide they demand it.
I think the one thing that always needs to be made clear when we have these conversations is that voter fraud is not a thing. The issue is voter suppression. And you will never hear the Republicans talk about voter suppression. So whenever they start complaining about mail-in ballots or any of these other issues, what they're attempting to do is suppress the vote. It is not to prevent voter fraud, because that is not a real issue. Voter suppression is, and that's what people need to be paying attention to.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that.
I want to just hit one more thing on this subject, and then we're going to take a break, which is the I should note that the president yesterday on COVID-19 at a press conference, walked it back a little bit, walked back this idea of postponing the election. But we had an interesting comment from David Gergen on the show, an advisor to four presidents, including three Republican presidents, that I think is relevant to something that a couple of both of you have said. So here he is on the president's idea to delay and on how Republicans are responding.
I can't find a single Republican who's come out in favor of what the president said today. He's been unanimously rejected by his party as well as by the Democrats. So that's good news that the country may finally, and the Republican Party may finally be willing to break with Trump on some things that are perfectly obvious to most Americans. That's encouraging.
And here's Governor Baker responding to it yesterday at a press conference.
We've had elections in the midst of world wars. We've had an election in the midst of a civil war. We've had elections many times in this country during terrible, awful circumstances, but elections need to happen, and there's no reason why this one can't happen.
So there's an example of the pushback from the governor that David Gergen was talking about. When we come down to these truly fundamental tenets of democracy, are we at a point, since Tom, you said that you believe the Republican Party is trying to save down-ticket races now, where we are going to see more pushback? Just briefly, Renee.
Well, I always think it's important to mention that Trump has no authority to move the election. None. So I think, the conversation can almost end with that. He thinks he can. He wants to talk about it. He has no authority to do so. So, it doesn't behoove Republicans at this point to say maybe he's got a point. They're trying to save their own political skins at this point. So, no, they're not going to agree with him. And they're going to come out, as they did, quickly and forcefully to say the election is going to be November 3rd.
Tom, last word for you before I go to a break.
Sure. I think what they're going to do is try and memory hole this like they do with all of his other totally off the wall statements. They're going to shake their heads and say, he's just spitballing. November 3rd will happen. And then they're going to want to forget that that happened, even though what just happened was the president of the United States conducted an appalling attack on our democratic norms and on our democratic system of elections. But as Renee says, he has no power to do this. He did it purely as a rationalization for why he might lose. And Republicans now, instead of a full-throated defense of the Constitution and our democratic system, they're going to mumble and they're going to walk away from it. But they are not going to break with him. They are not going to break with him right up to Election Day. And then on November 4th, you're going to find a whole bunch of Republicans who are going to say, I was never on his side.
I want to move us into a discussion about the relevance, that's such an inappropriate or not strong enough word, of the passing of John Lewis and the legacy of his life this week. And I want to take us there. So I'm going to take us to the church yesterday for his invitation only memorial service. There were three presidents there. The sitting U.S. president was not one of them. And I want to play some sound of words from two presidents of the United States. Here is George Bush reflecting on John Lewis.
Listen, John and I had our disagreements, of course. But in the America John Lewis fought for, and the America I believe in, differences of opinion are inevitable elements and evidence of democracy in action. We, the people, including congressmen and presidents, can have differing views on how to perfect our union, while sharing the conviction that our nation, however flawed, is at heart a good and noble one.
And then at the end of the service, President Obama delivered the eulogy. And he described at one point speaking with John Lewis after a Zoom forum with young leaders who were protesting the police killing of George Floyd.
He could not have been prouder to see this new generation of activists standing up for freedom and equality. A new generation that was intent on voting and protecting the right to vote. In some cases, a new generation running for political office. And I told him, all those young people, John, of every race and every religion, from every background and gender and sexual orientation, John, those are your children. They learned from your example. Even if they didn't always know it.
Renee, he didn't die of COVID-19. He died of cancer. And yet there's something about his passing and the reflections that it's brought forward that seem to underscore this truly existential moment we find ourselves in as a nation. Why does he bring it all forward so clearly?
You know, since the pandemic began, we're talking about before the protests, after the killing of George Floyd, there's been this attention throughout the country on white supremacy and systemic racism, and how that has impacted the disproportionate number of people of color who have gotten sick and who have died, but also have been disproportionately impacted economically during this pandemic. These are all issues that John Lewis fought for 60 years. And so here he was, you know, this sort of living symbol of this nation's struggles and what it takes to try to even move this country forward, even an inch. That is a lifetime of work to make that change. You know, that's the point that I think a lot of the speakers were making, that this isn't something you do and then you go home and it's over. John Lewis never stopped. And all the issues that, frankly, people of color have been talking about for centuries, that now everyone seems to suddenly notice, these are the issues that he has been fighting for his entire life. Until his last day, he was fighting these issues. You know, that's the poignancy of John Lewis's life, but also losing him in this moment. His loss also talked to me, speaks to how a torch was passed to him, and now he has passed that torch. And now another generation has to keep moving it forward. That's all we have in this country. One generation after another, seeing what's wrong and moving the needle, moving it forward till we finally get to that more perfect union.
Tom Nichols, I was struck in watching both of the presidents that we just played yesterday, how it felt like I had been crawling through the desert, and here was this incredibly needed drink of water with these two leaders who represent different political parties and different political views, with a very cleared intersection of shared vision about who we need to be as a common American people and who we need to be as a democracy. How do we process that? And what's the message of that? We've just gotten an incredible set of messages from Renee that are one part of the legacy we have to carry forward. There's this other one too. How do we process it, and what do we take away from that?
Well, first, it was such a blessedly normal moment. And unfortunately, it happened at the funeral of a great man. But it was almost a shock to see it, to say, wow, there was once a time where we didn't politicize everything, where we recognized the basic decency of an American hero, even if we didn't always agree. And I thought seeing Barack Obama and George Bush there was a reminder that this, we're capable of doing this, that it doesn't have to be, we don't have to live the way we've been living for the past 4 years. We just don't. I think also it was a great reminder that I'm sure for people like, you know, Bush, I'll speak for myself. I grew up in Western Massachusetts. I was a white kid growing up in Chicopee. John Lewis was not part of my consciousness. He became part of my consciousness over time as an adult, you know, right up until the moment he passed away. The idea that there would be a sitting president who simply says, I didn't like him and I'm not going to that funeral, it still shocks me. And I bring up my own background because I didn't come from a background where I was predisposed to say, yes, I know who John Lewis was. Yes, I grew up with him. Yes, I had the same awareness of these issues in the way that Renee did, for example. But John Lewis was one of the people who made those issues become important to me. And so it was important to me to see people from every part of the political spectrum there. And the fact that even at this last moment, in this horrendous national pandemic, in this moment of great division, you know, the president and his people still found a way to politicize this in the most vulgar, distasteful, and un-American way possible. And that actually makes me think even more about John Lewis and his legacy, because it tells me that, you know, we're not done.
I feel like I need to say this. What purpose would Trump have served at John Lewis's homecoming? He didn't like John Lewis because John Lewis always recognized the divisive and racist man that Donald Trump is. He called Donald Trump an illegitimate president and did not attend Trump's inauguration. And Grudge Collector that Trump is, he had no intention of honoring John Lewis. There were three living presidents there, and Jimmy Carter sent a letter of condolence and remembrance. No one needed Donald Trump there.
I understand. So, I think, you know, it would require Donald Trump to be a different kind of person, but I think we're just so used to the idea, at least we were until 4 years ago, that the president is, that the office is bigger than the person. And it was another reminder that Trump has shrunk the office to be no bigger than his own tiny personality, his own small grudges. So Renee, I agree with you. I don't know that it would have served a purpose to be there, but it was a shocking reminder that this is the place we've come to, where the president of all of the American people, you know, stays away from the funeral of somebody that is important to millions of Americans, you know, of every political confession. And he did it just because he's such a small person. And having Bush and Obama there was a reminder that it didn't used to be this way, and it doesn't have to be this way.
So I know none of these listeners are calling in, and I hear the force of what you're both saying. I do just want to note that we are going to have listeners today who feel that you are being, both of you are being unfairly harsh on the president here. And it is an interesting moment, and I'll shift us in a second from this. It is an interesting moment in that we are now in a moment where we are holding up a lens both on the man, but also now on the presidency, as we go into another phase of elections where we're going to choose who holds the office, but also, I think, as the two of you are pointing out, what the office stands for, you know, in this moment. So I think from there, I want to move us to our hubbubs, which sometimes after these difficult news conversations we're having almost feel too light. But at the same time, it's Friday, and it's really good to bring more of our world into our point of view. So these are those brief local stories or events that caught our attention this week. And I know all three of us have them. So Renee, let me start with you. What is your hubbub for this week?
Yeah, it's not exactly happy, but I wanted to mention that the Jewish Cemetery Association of Massachusetts unveiled the nation's first permanent COVID-19 memorial in West Roxbury. And, you know, it's an evocation in real time, even as this horror continues. And I really hope that it can serve as a place of reflection and solace, especially for those who could not be with their loved ones at the end.
And how about you, Tom? What's yours?
Well, as always, although I am a son of the Commonwealth, I now live in our great neighboring state of Rhode Island. So my hubbubs are always a greater Boston ocean state hubbub. And it was a positive sign in a bad time. We had a bad week in Rhode Island where cases started to creep up. And I want to give a hubbub shout out to our governor, Gina Raimondo, who came out and said, you know, knock it off, knock the partying off. You know, this is what leaders are supposed to do. She stepped forward. She said, we're contact tracing. We know how this case increase happened. We know it's because of parties and gatherings that are too big. You know, and I kind of laughed because I came in to watch and my wife said, the governor's giving everybody what for. And I think sometimes that's what a governor's job is. It's not popular and it's not fun, but I was really happy to see that, you know, here in Rhode Island, which has handled the pandemic pretty well, the governor got right on television and said, look, you know, your behavior is the problem. Stop doing this. So that's a big thumbs up on an elected governor telling people to kind of get their act together and behave like responsible adults. And I don't think we can ever see too much of that.
All right. So you two had very thoughtful, responsible, and important hubbubs. And I'm a little embarrassed because I have none of the above in my hubbub today. But hopefully it'll bring you a little, maybe mildly vindictive chuckle. So here's what I have for you this week. And I think the headline in the Buffalo News, yes, Buffalo, says it all. Here's the headline. Quote, Lackawanna woman died as she lived, hating Tom Brady. End quote. So this is a true story out of Buffalo this week. A woman named Carol Scarsella passed away recently, and her death notice, her family put together, and it's not clear to me whether she put it together first or her family did this, five things that either she or her family wanted to make sure the world knew about her life. Now, her death is a tragedy, but she invited us with this choice to take a chuckle because there were some wonderful things on the list, her love of reading, her love of slot machines. But number five in caps was that she hated Tom Brady, the former quarterback of the New England Patriots, which just gave me a chuckle. And I want to read the text of a tweet from her granddaughter, Aggie. And this is as reported in the Buffalo News. So this is what Aggie tweeted, quote, "I miss her endlessly, but I'm glad she is remembered. And the people of Buffalo also share her deep-rooted hatred of Tom Brady." End quote. So, listen, if our love and our passion can't bring us together, sometimes our hatred or love, because there are going to be listeners out there who are not pleased with Carol, even in her passing right now, can bring us together around our sports figures. All right, Renee Graham, Boston Globe columnist and WBUR contributor. I appreciate you being on Week in Review today, Renee, and that fantastic hubbub. That's good to know about. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
And Tom Nichols, a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and the Harvard Extension School, and a senior advisor to the Lincoln Project. Tom, I appreciate you coming back on the show today as well.
Always great to be back. Thanks, Tiziana.
And to the listeners who called in today, hey, thank you for being part of the show. It's great to have your voices, and keep calling in to our Week in Review in the weeks to come.